So we have a duo coming up next. I'm very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Michael Wiseman, who is an assistant professor in the Faculty of Dentistry and an adjunct professor in the Faculty of Medicine at McGill. He's been practicing dentistry for the past 25 years and is well published in the field of mouth care, particularly with palliative care patients. Presenting with him is, can you hear me? Presenting with him is Heather Hall, who is a clinical nurse specialist working at the Jewish General Hospital, where she has been for the past 4 years, approximately. And please join me in welcoming them.
So first of all, we'd like to thank the organizing committee for inviting us to speak today. And we had a hard time initially, Heather and I, because I didn't know which jaw to talk about, the maxilla or the mandible. We finally got together and we divided the whole topic up evenly, okay? To start with, at the outset, we'd like to declare we have no conflict of interest at all, receiving no honoraria, unfortunately. No, sorry. The multidisciplinary palliative care team involves a whole bunch of allied professionals. We have everything from the chaplains to social workers, psychologists, dietitians, speech pathologists, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, family, and even dentists sometimes. And basically, the goal is to provide whole person comfort care, take care of their emotional, spiritual, and physical support to improve their quality of life. All together, all the professionals work together to be patient and family directed in their care approach. Unfortunately, as a dentist, I think it's really my fault as a dentist, because studies have found that many hospice and palliative care centers do not have dentists associated with them. And I think it's the fault of dentistry not reaching out to medicine to say, hey guys, we're here too, and we can be of aid. So it's not your fault, it's our fault. So I invite my field, my practice, my community as dentists to work with you together. We've had a few definitions today about palliative care medicine, and this is one we had the WHO. This is one done in Great Britain in 1987, and basically it says palliative care medicine is a study and management of patients with active, progressive, far advanced disease for whom the prognosis is limited and the focus of care is quality of life. Well, I kind of took that and I tweaked it for dentistry, and this is my definition of palliative care dentistry. Again, it's the palliative care dentistry now is a study and management of patients with active progressive disease for whom the oral cavity has been compromised by the disease directly, such as oral cancer, or treatment of another disease that affects the oral cavity. And the focus of care, of course, is always quality of life. This is a schematic that we're going to be showing throughout the day, and it's very busy, so I'm not going to go through everything on the slide right now, but these are some of the issues that Heather and I are going to be tackling today, and we hope we'll be out there to understand any of our lecture, and we're here to answer any questions afterwards. Take it away, Heather.
Thank you, Dr. Wiseman. Michael. Okay. So I'm going to start off by setting the stage a little bit as to why we are talking about the mouth in palliative care. And then I'm going to go really back to basics and review the mouth and go into general oral hygiene, because I don't think it hurts to review. And then Michael will be going into the nitty-gritty of all the different oral conditions that can show up in our population and how to treat them. So that's a little bit about how our presentation is going to go. So the mouth. I think that the mouth is often an organ that we take for granted. It's not until we have a problem with our mouths that we finally realize its value and its importance in our daily lives. So why do we care about the mouth in palliative care? So look at all the things here that this diagram is showing you. These are things that we do with our mouths in our daily lives. So we sing with our mouths, we communicate, we're intimate with our mouths, we're able to call up our relatives on the telephone that we haven't spoken to in a really long time. We use our mouths to eat. So if we have a problem with our mouth, it definitely has the capacity to interfere with all of these things. And at the end of life, ignoring these problems can severely impact overall functioning and decrease overall quality of life. So that's why we're talking about this today. So all domains of quality of life can be affected by oral disease. So most obviously, you have the physical domain. So if you have oral disease or conditions, they can create pain and discomfort, and that can lead as well to local or systemic infection. And then the combination of these two can lead the patient to have difficulty swallowing, then decreased PO intake, and finally malnutrition. Functionally, oral problems can have an effect on chewing. It can have an effect on taste and actually create taste disorders. So this can lead to a decreased appetite as well as a decreased interest in food in general. And then finally, speech can be impaired as well. This leads to a decreased ability for the patient at the end of life to take part in meaningful communication with their family and loved ones. Psychologically, oral problems can interfere with the patient's relationships, can interfere with communication, and finally can decrease the overall self-esteem that the patient has. So at the end of life, there are changes in the mouth that increase the risk of mouth-related problems. So there's a functional deterioration of the tongue, as well as a functional deterioration of the salivary glands. And in our population, it's more specifically in patients with cancer who are in the terminal phase of their illness, there are several risk factors that are present that can predispose them to developing problems with their oral cavity. So this is a list. It's not an exhaustive one, but just to show you a few examples. So for example, patients are on medications that can cause xerostomia, which is a dry mouth. And often they're on a number of them that have this side effect. Patients who are on oxygen can have problems with their mouths as oxygen use is extremely drying. Patients can also have ill-fitting dentures at this phase of their lives, which can cause trauma to the mouth, and then this trauma to the mouth can lead to infection and mouth pain and discomfort. Patients who have anxiety or depression often have problems with dry mouth. And you'll also have a patient with head and neck cancer who have received radiation therapy to the area who are at extremely high risk of developing mucositis, which Michael will discuss a little bit later. And also, a lot of the patients, they don't just have one of these risk factors, they present with a number of them. So it's important to be able to identify these patients and be able to anticipate and then possibly prevent problems from occurring down the line. So almost all patients in the terminal phase of life will have oral problems at some point. So the buccal cavity has been found to be often the first site of pain, discomfort, or disorder in patients with advanced cancer. So what is the prevalence of oral problems in the palliative population? Well, it can be very high. In some studies, xerostomia or dry mouth is seen in up to 97% of patients. And you can see that for candidiasis or thrush, in one study it was found to be present in up to 85% of patients with advanced cancer. And other mouth care problems, oral problems, are present in significant proportion. So in view of this, what is the importance placed on mouth care in hospital settings? I'm speaking from a nursing perspective and looking at the nursing literature that is out there, and there have been numerous studies that have been performed that have looked at the quality of mouth care being provided. In all of the studies that were performed, it was found that across settings, the quality of mouth care is extremely poor. This is as evident in palliative care as it is in oncology, as it is critical care, geriatrics, nursing homes, etc. So in these studies, nurses were interviewed to try and determine why this was a problem and why mouth care wasn't being performed up to standards. And the reasons behind this are numerous, but it's really due in large part to the lack of knowledge and the lack of training that is offered in nursing schools on this topic. So one study mentioned that 72% of nursing schools fail to teach any kind of oral assessment or any kind of mouth care in their curriculum. Most textbooks do not even discuss this issue. There is one prominent palliative care textbook that has about 1,200 pages in it, but only four are devoted to mouth care, so it's like 0.5% of the material. There's also little interest into research in mouth care, so there's really a lack of an evidence base to then be able to develop recommendation and standards of care, so there's not a lot of information out there. And lastly, nurses were found to be really reticent to perform this task. They felt it was unpleasant because of timing or perhaps staffing issues. It was prioritized a lot lower on their list of things to do. And others felt that this task could easily be delegated to support staff, or they found that the patients were resistant to this type of care, or they were aggressive, so they wouldn't offer it. So these are just two quotes to emphasize the role that nurses can have in oral health, as well as just impacting the overall quality of life. So with adequate training, nurses can identify oral health problems, be able to initiate interventions, and then prevent and minimize significant morbidity associated with poor oral health. And that the delivery of oral care is a skilled nursing activity that encompasses components of assessment, goal setting, care delivery, and evaluation. So there's a very important role that nurses can play in oral health and management of conditions. So how do we assess patient mouths? Well, firstly, mouth assessment should be routine and systematic, and should really be performed and documented for every patient that you see either in a clinic or that you admit onto your service. After this first this first assessment is done, there's no consensus in the literature as to how often the assessment should be performed afterwards, but it should be, for a hospitalized patient, a minimum of 2 times per week. And then you can maybe increase that more if your patient has numerous risk factors that are present or if they have an ongoing oral problem that needs daily attention. So in terms of assessing the oral cavity, I wasn't going to go into a detailed list of how to do this. There's not really a right or wrong way. Just the importance is to be systematic and to use a flashlight or a pen light to be able to visualize all areas of the mouth and not to neglect the back of the throat, which can often have a thrush present, as well as the roof of the mouth. If you have a patient who's not able to move their tongue around themselves, it's easy to use a 2x2 gauze to secure the tongue and be able to then move it so you can see underneath the tongue as well. Do not forget to always wear gloves when in contact with the oral mucosa. So I just want to really briefly review the mouth and its structures. Doesn't hurt to review. So the mouth is composed of 3 essential organs. There's the teeth, the tongue, and the salivary glands, and most of the mouth is covered by a mucosa. So this is a picture of a normal, healthy mouth. So there are 32 teeth in the adult, and less if you've had your wisdom teeth removed. And the function of teeth are mainly to cut, to tear, to chew food in order to be able to prepare the food for swallowing. The tongue fills most of the mouth, has an average length of 4 inches, and is made of flexible skeletal muscle. And it serves 3 very important functions. It helps to prepare the food for swallowing. It serves an important function in the pronunciation of words, so speech, and also the taste buds are able to create the sensation of taste. Salivary glands excrete saliva, and saliva is an aqueous solution containing mucus, ions, minerals, and enzymes. So there are 3 major salivary glands. There's the parotid gland, which is the largest. I don't know if you can... this thing. So this is the parotid gland. It's the largest, but it produces 25% of the total saliva. And then you have the submandibular gland that's located at the base of the tongue, right over here, and that actually produces 70% of the total saliva. And then finally, the sublingual gland, as well as other minor glands that are scattered throughout the mouth. So in a healthy person, saliva is produced at a rate of 1 to 1.5 liters per day, and it serves numerous important functions. It definitely protects and preserves the mouth from developing significant problems. So it protects the tissues. Saliva also contains digestive enzymes, contains ions for the maintenance of healthy teeth. It lubricates the mouth to be able to swallow more easily, and it hydrates the mouth as well as the larynx for speaking. And finally, it serves an antimicrobial function. The buccal mucosa, as you can see here, it covers much of the mouth. It serves an absorptive and a secretory function. And the absorptive function is important to keep in mind if you have a patient who has sublingual or buccal medications and they also have a dry mouth. The mouth needs to be moistened in order for that medication to be absorbed. So lastly, I want to go into just to talk about general oral hygiene. So this is really basic stuff, but so this is oral hygiene that we would do for ourselves as well as for our patients. So this diagram on the right-hand side just shows how poor oral hygiene can exacerbate xerostomia by leading to cavities, periodontal disease, and finally halitosis, or bad breath, which can significantly impact our interpersonal relationships at the end of life. So what is the purpose of oral hygiene? The purpose is to ensure well-being and comfort, to maintain the overall function of the mouth, to maintain the humidity of the mouth and the mucosa, as well as keeping the oral mucosa intact. And in doing all of these things, it prevents significant complications from occurring, such as infections, stomatitis, gingivitis, etc. So patients who engage in regular and thorough oral hygiene may not develop the numerous problems that Dr. Wiseman will be speaking about later on. So how do we do oral hygiene? The first thing is to clean the teeth, and this is done using toothpaste and a soft bristled toothbrush, and not one of these swabs that are provided often by the hospital. Many studies have shown that the swabs are not as effective in removing debris and plaque from the mouth. However, they may be more tolerated by the patients. So if your patient is refusing to use a toothbrush, a swab is better than nothing. Toothbrushing should take at least over a minute to perform, so it shouldn't take just 20 seconds. It should be a minute and even up to 4 minutes. And also they should be encouraged to brush their tongue if they're able. The mouth then should be rinsed with water, or preferably using a mouthwash, which I'll discuss on the next slide. Flossing is encouraged if your patient is able to and if it's not contraindicated. And if your patient has dentures, they really should be cleaned every night using a denture cleanser such as Polident. And then finally, the lips need to be kept hydrated using a water-based lubricant or a lip balm if that's what they prefer. So these 4 or 5 steps performed regularly can significantly improve patients' overall quality of life. So the purpose of mouthwash is to rinse the mouth, to protect the mouth against bacteria, and to remove any debris that might cause bad breath. An important point for a mouthwash is that it is not a substitute for toothbrushing. It should be done in conjunction with teeth brushing and not as a substitute for it. So there hasn't been many studies out there that have looked at one mouthwash compared to another one. The emphasis is more on the regular and frequent oral care and not a specific rinse. So if you start a patient on a specific mouthwash, it's just important to assess the effect of it and whether there are any adverse effects from that rinse, and then keep evaluating that way. So these are a number of mouthwash choices. So there's the alcohol-free mouthwash. Alcohol, such as the Listerine, can have an extremely drying effect on the mouth and can exacerbate xerostomia in your patient. So that's not recommended. So an alcohol-free mouthwash, such as Oral-B anti-cavity rinse, or a mouthwash that's provided in the hospital contains settled peridinium, which is an antiseptic rinse. So these are all options. If your patient finds that it's too strong a taste in their mouths, this can be diluted with some water or some saline and given to them that way. You can do a mouthwash with a mixture of hydrogen peroxide in a ratio of 1:3. You can make an alkaline saline mouthwash, which is easy, as well as use a diluted chlorhexidine mouthwash that is alcohol-free is preferred. So the hydrogen peroxide, it's important to note that while it does have a very good cleansing effervescent effect, it can destroy granulating tissues. And so this effect is noted even at 50% dilution. So that's why we recommend to dilute it even further. And just to note that when it's diluted, it's only stable for 2 days in a container, so it needs to be changed often. So it's important to always maintain caution and avoid using hydrogen peroxide in any patient where the mucosa is damaged or inflamed or ulcerated. So an alkaline saline mouthwash is very easy to make. It's inexpensive, so your patient can even do it themselves at home. They mix half a teaspoon of salt and baking soda, and it's a very mild mouthwash that doesn't have a strong taste. What kind of toothpaste should they use? Any toothpaste is fine. There is a substance in most toothpaste called sodium lauryl sulfate, which is a soap-type substance, and this can actually cause ulcerations in some patients. So in this case, a variety of toothpastes can be a good alternative, such as Sensodyne or children's toothpastes can be used as well. So what is the frequency of oral hygiene? Well, at the end of life, it should be done at least 3 to 4 times per day in patients who are still eating, who are awake and alert. And if they're not, it should be performed even more regularly in order to be able to maintain humidity and comfort. So this could be going up to every 4 hours or even providing mouth care up to 2 hours in the patient who is really imminently dying. If the patient is able to do their own hygiene, or if the family is willing to be involved, they should be encouraged, educated, empowered as well. And at the very end of life, often family members are at the bedside. They feel helpless. They don't know what they can do. So they can be encouraged and taught how to provide this mouth care if they wish to get involved. So that helps the patient. It helps them feel useful and have something to do, and it also helps the nurse in his or her very busy schedule.
This slide here actually is composed by a real good friend of mine named Jane Chalmers. It's very appropriate that I use this slide today. It's a cookbook slide that we could provide as dentists to the palliative care team on how to treat a patient. Jane died at age of 35 in a palliative care unit in the University of Iowa. So I'm very happy to use this slide here today in her honor. We talk about some of the problems associated with mucositis associated from chemo or radiotherapy, which can be seen with patients receiving oral radiotherapy. There are a variety of reasons for that. One is that, you can see it well here, the chemotherapy and the radiotherapy starts destroying the basal layer of cells. You get apoptosis and necrosis of that layer. Furthermore, you get a cascade activity occurring there. You get further necrosis, and then you get invasion of bacteria, fungi, and viruses into the tissues, leading to a frank ulceration. Now, this stuff is very painful to patients. They often will suffer quite difficulty with a lot of pain. There are a variety of effects that can cause this. There's the therapeutic measures. This is the type and duration of the pharmacological agent that's been used, dose and field of irradiation that's being used, and there's local patient factors. Local factors include a poor feeding denture that could be rubbing on the mucosa, causing the ulcerations, poor restorations, and plaque accumulation. And, of course, this all is worsened in the immunocompromised patient because they're more prone to microbial invasion. Patients who are prone to vomiting, besides the obvious effect of the low pH associated with the vomit, they also will be depleted of valuable minerals, proteins, and vitamins needed for epithelial repair. There's a grading system for mucositis from 0 to 3, and I say 3 is a medical dental emergency. This is a case where a patient cannot eat or swallow, and they'll be dehydrated and can lead to death very soon. The key objective in mucositis and stomatitis is keep the mouth clean, moist, and infection-free. And we're going to talk a few of the ways that we can treat the pain associated with mucositis, stomatitis, and we're just like try to give you some cookbook stuff that you can use in your practice. You can use xylocaine, viscous sprays, or etc., or you can use dicyclone hydrochloride. You can even mix diphenhydramine, Benadryl, and Kelopectate 1:1 and paint it on lesions. That very is beneficial. But you got to be careful with any of the topical anesthetics that it will affect the gag reflex in your patients. And that could affect their ability to swallow and eat. So these are factors you always must be aware of. Magic mouthwash, often prescribed. I'm not a big fan of magic mouthwash personally, because I think it includes everything and the kitchen sink to try and treat the patient. And I, like, as a dentist, rather treat the exact problem associated with the patient. So crawl-face suspension has had in the literature somewhat positive success in treating the ulcerations. Capsaicin cream and capsaicin toffee, this gets rid of the substance P for pain, and it seems to work. And a quick little story, I got to say. There's a commercial that was on radio the last few years about Gordie Howe's elbows. And whenever Gordie has sore elbows, his wife rubs this cream on his elbows. It feels better. Well, I was lecturing in Leipzig, Germany. And this is a recipe, by the way, for capsaicin taffy, which you can make at home if you want. And I went and I was speaking to the audience. And half the second language there was Russian, not English. I can see who understood me. And I brought up Gordie Howe. And I looked at the room, I said, you guys don't know who Gordie Howe is, eh? So then I changed, when I lectured later on in the University of Gutenberg, I changed to Michael Schumacher driving his race car. So you learn to go for your audience, okay? So here are Gordie Howe I could use, okay? We can use Tantum, as has been found by Joel Epstein to be a very good product to help prevent the pain associated with mucositis. You can use topical 2% morphine, in which you train the patient first. You give them saline, and you have them rinse, expectorate the saline, and then you can give them the 2% morphine as a solution to rinse in their mouth and then expectorate. Glutamine supplements have been shown to help improve repair of the tissues. Vitamin E seems to have some potential effects, some. Again, as I said before, localized factors have to be corrected, i.e. problems from the restorations, the dentures, etc. Avoid spicy or hard foods because this can cause trauma, especially if the mouth is xerostomic. Imagine that cracker, which you can eat today, in a xerostomic patient, that cracker is like sandpaper in their mouth. So you got to use soft foods. Avoid alcohol and smoking. This is a recipe that a compounding pharmacist could make using Cytotec and diphenhydramine to make an oral rinse that the patients could use. A new product that I just got word of recently that's coming down the pipeline. I don't know if anybody's heard of it. Capfosol? Anybody heard of it? It's a new product that's coming through that actually may prevent mucositis and help decrease the severity of mucositis. And it's a solution containing high amounts of calcium and phosphate ions. And that seems to be potentially protective of the tissues. So look for that. That's coming down the pipeline. What we do next is talk about xerostomia, and this could be present, of course, from radiotherapy or from a variety of causes. This is an interesting study that was done. They went and they questioned nurses, physicians, and the patients as to what if they had xerostomia. Now, xerostomia, first let me give you a quick definition. Xerostomia means a subjective sense of dryness versus a thing called salivary gland hypofunction, which is a quantitative measure of saliva. So we're talking about patients feel their mouth being dry. In this study, nurses found that 39% of their patients' mouths were dry. Physicians thought only 16% of their patients' mouths were dry. And in this study, patients found 73% of their mouths were dry. So it's been underdiagnosed, the xerostomia. In other studies, they found that xerostomia can range from 45 to 71%. But the main cause, we know that causing xerostomia is drug use. And the drug use includes a variety of classes. We've talked about this today, the treating depression, the tricyclic antidepressants, the antipsychotics, the benzodiazepines, the atropinics, the beta blockers, and the antihistamines. All these drug classes can cause dry mouth. The SSRI inhibitors thought to be a good alternative to a lot of the other antidepressant medications, still cause a dry mouth in patients' mouths. A quick little study I did at Mount Sinai, this was not published yet because I think I want to redo it and get bigger numbers. I just looked at 25 patients, and I looked, of the 25 patients, how many were taking a variety of these classes of drugs? And I just want to look, tick. If they're taking two drugs in the same class, I count it just as one drug class. And of the 25 patients, the average age being 78, they are obviously taking five different classes of xerogenic medications. So in general, our patients are taking lots of meds out there that will cause a dry mouth. All the patients I queried all complained they had a dry mouth. So how do we treat the xerostomia? One is drink a lot, okay? Promote hydration, humidify the room, put a humidifier that will help treat desiccated tissues. This happens to be perhaps the driest mouth I've ever seen in my clinical practice. And unfortunately, even the slides can never give it pure justice. She was bleeding from spontaneously from the corners of her mouth. Her tongue was sticking to her oral tissues. And she had a miserable existence. She died that evening. But prior to her death, I instituted Toothette's rubbing variety of products on her, anywhere I tell nurses, anywhere they see pink. And we use often KY jelly, taro gel, muca jelly. I've tasted the stuff. It has a little bit of a funny taste. If you patient could afford oral balance gel, it tastes better. It works a little better. But financial is a problem. The other products work just as good. Moisture swabs work well. And these are some new products in the dental care business. One being the GC Dry Mouth and the other being MI Paste, all by GC America. The GC Dry Mouth is like the oral balance gel. It actually seems to be a little bit better in my eyes. But MI Paste is rather interesting. It's a new product, again, that actually remineralizes teeth at the same time as hydrating the tissues. The only negative about that product is white in color, and the other product is clear. Some patients may not want to have white kind of liquids in their mouth. It doesn't look nice when they want to talk to their loved ones. But that's where the clear one would work better. But the MI Paste, in my opinion, would work much better for remineralization. Saliva stimulants can divide in two categories. The proprioceptive ones, such as chewing gum and organic acids, and the sympathetic agents, such as pilocarpine bethanacol. This is an example of products we can give our patients. If they're cognitive and awake, we give them sugarless mints. We can chewing gum to chew on. We can use, again, as we've talked about, the saliva substitutes. That's the ZeroLube Moisture. This is a product called OroMoist. It's a little disc that adheres itself to the palate in the mouth. And a study done in JADA, the Journal of the American Dental Association, not Dietetic Association, has stated that the results were somewhat ambiguous, whether it actually was effective. It was like a 50-50. So the jury's still out there, but if patients want to investigate it and see if it helps them, anything's worth a try. And it's a 1-centimeter disc that fits in the mouth. Organic acids, citric acids, malic acid and vitamin C. I know you're going to get all this in on a CD, so I am going kind of fast. I see some people trying to write down these things. They all work well in stimulating saliva, but the negative is that they all will cause demineralization of teeth. So you want to promote good oral care to these patients, as Heather stated. When we look at the saliva stimulants, we can use pilocarpine ophthalmic solutions. Salagen, which is a tablet, works well. Bethanacol, citric acid, as I stated. A good product that's available in the States only is Evozac. The nice thing about this product versus Salagen is the half-life. Salagen's half-life is 30 minutes. Evozac's half-life is 5 hours. I've asked the company if they're planning to come to Canada, and the answer is no. Too small market, unfortunately. So what artificial saliva substitutes do we have? Again, we have the moisture and mouth coat. You can make your own stock solution here by using some methocellulose, some lemon essence, and adding water. Mucin-based mouthwashes. These are derived from the porcine gastric mucosa. And when I spoke to rabbis and to imams about this question, being from pigs, is there any problem with it? And the answer is no. For medical purposes, you can break the so-called religious bounds when it comes to pork products. No problem at all. Let's talk a little bit now about candidiasis, or as I like calling it, fungus among us. Okay. How do I treat that? Well, you can give nystatin suspension to a patient. You can give them 5 mLs. You say, Mr. Jones, please swish this around your mouth for 20 seconds and swallow it. Okay? In average, the patient will go in 3 seconds. Okay? The product does not work well systemically. It works better topically. So what I often will give is vaginal suppositories, which I'll tell the patient to suck on. I tell them it's a candy. Okay? When they're outpatients, like in my private practice, they get the box. They know it's not a... it's a vaginal suppository, so I tell them the truth then. You can use troches if you can get it. One of the problems you have with the patients who are semi-comatose, you can't give them a pill. You can't give them a liquid because they're going to aspirate it. So what I've done, I've taken 5 mLs. Empirically, there's no scientific studies, unfortunately, behind my research. I've done 5 mLs of mucus jelly or KY jelly, any of the water-soluble products, with 5 mLs of nystatin, and painted it onto the tissues, and it adheres well to the oral mucosa and acts topically. For patients who have a burning mouth syndrome, what I've done, I've taken 5 mLs of sugarless fruit juice, added 5 mLs of nystatin, made popsicles out of it, and have the patient suck on it. What I like about that is that the popsicles provide cryotherapy, cooling down the mouth. It's acting topically in the mouth longer, and the patient at the same time is being hydrated. So it's kind of hitting all the birds at one time. Okay, and I also like writing one popsicle QID, but that's my own personal thing. You can use vaginal creams. Okay, that you put inside the dentures and put it onto the oral tissues. Okay, and that works really well. Okay, because it works topically longer. The problem with nystatin is that it has lots of sugar in it. And we feed the fungus as we try to kill it. I've asked the manufacturer why, and I said, can you not put a sugar-free nystatin? And their answer to me was they'd have to go for retesting all over again, and it costs too much money, and they don't make enough money on the product. So sugar it is. But here is a formulation, if your pharmacist wants to make it for you, of a sugar-free oral suspension. I hope I have it long enough so that it'll be on the DVD. This is good enough? Yeah, okay, thank you. Another thing we have to look at is the whole body of the patient. Look at the whole face. This is an example of a patient that has angular colitis. Right there, you can see the arrows, okay? This is sometimes due to poor-fitting dentures, lack of vertical dimension, or just some dry mouth, and you get pulling the saliva in the corners of their lips over here. Well, you get fungi growth there, and the way I treat that is I use an antibacterial soap first, then I pat it dry, patient pat it dry, or nurse pat it dry, and then we put topical nystatin ointment on top of that, and that seems to help that. We can use systemic agents such as the ketoconazole or fluconazole. They work really well. And, hey, I use it. When everything else fails, I will use the systemic agents. But we got to know there's caution. These drugs interact with many other drugs. And if a patient, for instance, is taking midazolam or triazolam as a sedative agent, giving a systemic antifungal, as we all know, will raise levels of these agents to toxic levels. So one has to be very careful with using systemic antifungals. Herpes infections. I heard a yuck out there, but I see it all the time. Herpes is very common in your immunocompromised palliative care patients. And you can use the variety of the ciclovir family of drugs out there to treat these patients. But again, we use kale pectate and Benadryl and paint that onto the lesions, and that will provide palliative care approach to their pain associated with the herpes lesions. I call this slide guck and throat. Okay, this is a typical semi-comatose patient who will have secretions going to the back of their throat. And if I was to culture that, that would be teeming with fungus and bacteria and all sorts of nasty bugs that will make the patient's life worse. So what I do, I recommend you take a 4x4, wrapping around a tongue depressor, such as that, dipping that into some chlorhexidine, and using that to scrape off gently off the back of the palate this guck, and I use the technical word guck, off the palate, and makes the patient more comfortable. Nice thing about chlorhexidine, it binds to the oral tissues, so it's slowly released, and will help fight further infection. In fact, chlorhexidine, we all promote toothbrushing, and I would rather have a patient use a toothbrush than a foam brush, but if the last activity, the patient cannot handle a toothbrush, take your foam toothbrush and dip that in chlorhexidine. It will help decrease the plaque levels dramatically. Taste alterations. This is often associated, of course, with the xerostomia. We need saliva to dissolve the chemical mediators of food. 25 to 50% of cancer patients have either agusias, hypogusia, or dysgusia. And with advanced disease, these patients often require more sugar added to their foods to taste it. And that may be fine for some people out there, but for me as a dentist, more sugar being added to foods means more caries. So I would probably suggest, if possible, use some sugar-free substitutes. A variety of medications out there can cause dysgusia. And we're not going to go through the entire list, but example would be phenytoin, decreases your taste sensitivity. Levodopa creates a metallic taste in the mouth. Lithium can make dairy foods taste rancid. So your patients will take a variety of medications that they're having, and that will definitely affect their ability to taste foods. So what do I recommend for the patient for taste disorders? Rinse their mouth with artificial saliva prior to eating. Because if their mouth is dry, as I said, they're not going to taste food. Another thing you could do is make sure that you give foods with a lot of gravy in it. Okay? Like chicken pot pie, stuff that with a lot of... I'm not going to cook. Stuff that with a lot of gravy in there to help tasting and swallowing. Okay? Zinc supplementation does help. And if you give 220 milligrams TID, it will improve taste in patients' mouths. What we find also, you get dysphagia in the palliative care patients, and this can be due to a variety of causes. One is a physical obstruction produced by tumors or nodes, reduction in the tongue mobility produced by the tumor surgery or hypoglossal nerve paralysis, trismus of the masticatory muscles, xerostomia, and of course soft palate paralysis. Now how do we provide oral care in a patient like that without them aspirating on solutions? Well, this is one of my inventions, which I've done. I take a French trach tube, okay? I take I don't get money from Oral-B, so I'm going to say if it's Oral-B toothbrush, it is. But I take an Oral-B toothbrush, and I drill a hole through with my Black & Decker drill through the head right there, okay? You can't really see it that well. And I cut the trach tube, so the end I tape to the back of the toothbrush right here, and I run the tube underneath the toothbrush, and I make it just to enough the tube sticks up below the bristles so it won't affect brushing. And I connect the end here to a suction line on the bedside wall and suction as I brush. Okay, very simple product, okay, that one could use to prevent dysphagia in your patients. The problem with, we talked about depression today, for instance, when you have poor oral cavity, okay, people don't want to be near you. Your breath has tremendous bad mal odor. Your gums are inflamed, bleeding spontaneously. And then you get more depressed. You take more antidepressants, make your mouth more drier, causing further reactions. Okay. One of the things what we do at Mount Sinai, and I'm sure every hospital has, does really good things to help to treat the depression with good care of the chaplains involved in the hospital. This rabbi and a priest over here, talking to patient families, try to ease the burden associated with palliative care. We celebrate birthdays, the music therapist sings songs, and that's me as Santa Claus visiting the patients, okay? I practice hard for that job. One of the problems we see is that we might have bleeding problems associated with the patients, and there are a variety of techniques to control bleeding, topical bleeding problems, but some of the things I don't really recommend, I have it listed here, for instance, electrocautery, silver nitrate. This is very painful for patients. I've used the transaminic acid. That seems to work very well on 2x2s to control the bleeding. One of the things that we do know with head and neck cancer patients, and this is studied down by Dropkin in 1983, especially with nurses, the more disfigured a patient is from the head and neck cancer, the more nurses feel a little bit socially inhibited in treating the patient. And even though you are professionals, it does affect you. And this is where it's very important that the team itself be addressed, not just for the patient. You've got to treat yourselves as well to handle these types of patients. This is some quick case histories. This is Mr. M. He had a swelling in his jaws. You might be able to see in that slide there. This is the x-ray. And the biopsy report was there's a squamous cell carcinoma of his jaw. And what we would do if this patient was young, we'd basically resect his mandible, probably close to condyle to midline, and remove that jaw. But he was 80-plus years of age, and we had a family meeting with documented with consent. And we discussed things, and I suggested that this patient get palliative care radiotherapy. Unfortunately, as we learned from Mark, radiation does not know which is good cells, which is bad cells. We try to treat only bad cells, but this gentleman developed a fistula through and through his face here where pills and food were come through. And personally, I know his pain was gone, but his quality of life was affected. And as a clinician, I don't know if I did the right move, which way he should have gone. My last case history is the story here of Mrs. B. In my private practice, I beg food all the time from all my patients. And Mrs. B's husband brought a placenta plan and come Christmas time. And I said, Mrs. B, can I bake some cookies? And she said, I wish I could. Sure you can. I said, what am I saying? Words came out of my lips. I said it. So I said, we'll bake cookies together. So I had my wife fax me over a recipe from home, a kosher recipe because it was at Mount Sinai. And it was a shortbread cookies. And I brought up two metal basins, one with water so we can wash our hands together, the other with all the flour and all the ingredients. I'll tell you, they know how to cook. And we mixed it until it got too hard for Mrs. B to mix, and then I took over. And she put her hands into the cookie dough, and she put it on the tray. At this stage in her life, she was anorexic. We talked about that today, okay? And I went downstairs to the occupational therapy room. I baked the cookies. It's on a Friday. He came back to see her on a Monday, and her husband was there, and he said to me, you know, Michael, all weekend long, all she talked about were your cookies. All weekend long, all she ate was your cookies. So I didn't touch the patient, but I still call that palliative care dentistry. Okay? So finally, I was going to say, Fleming said in 1750, that it is not dying which is terrible. It's not death that is terrible, it is dying. Palliative care tries to make dying a better experience. Thank you very much. We'll take questions if you have any. None of us promised questions over there, but... Well, there's more, but I only had so much time. As I was telling Heather, I'd love to do a whole day on this, but personally, I'm just a dentist.
Frequently, when you're dealing with patients in palliative care, depending on what stage they're in, it's very difficult to get them to open their mouths, or sometimes they clamp down. Is there any secret that you've got so we can help to give the mouth care?
Well, part of it is communication. You got to demonstrate, you got to use oral signs, open your own mouth, from the patient, model behaviors if you can. But one of the things I do, if you're worried about being bitten, I take a stack of tongue depressors, about 5 tongue depressors. I've taped them together, and this is my own pointer so I can put it in my own mouth. A patient bites on one side. I got the contralateral side is now open. So by that means you can get in the mouth and brush that contralateral side and then switch over to the other side and do just as good a job. So it's one way to try to, and encourage, I put my pressure on the mandible here and try to gently open the mouth and talk to the patient. Very important that you're constantly talking to the patient. Explain what you're going to do.
I have a question for both Michael and Heather. I really enjoyed your presentation. I was wondering, Michael, from a dentist's point of view, and Heather, from being a volunteer at the Jewish General, I've noticed that a lot of patients, as they get cachexic, their dentures don't fit anymore, and that impacts on their ability to speak. So they're trying to speak, and their dentures are falling out, so you know you can't really understand them. And they're also very concerned that, you know, they want to put their dentures in, and you know. I was just wondering, is it possible at this stage for quality of life to have their dentures realigned, and or do we have the capabilities at the Jewish to have a consult to the dentistry department, or is it just...
Yes. Thank you. no, let me give you a few things here. First of all, you don't really lose a lot of mass on your palate. You do lose some, but not a tremendous amount. The main reason why that denture is not fitting anymore is by the fact that the muscles that were involuntarily holding up in place have weakened and have lost muscle tone, and denture will fall by gravity. Also, they're more xerostomic. There's salivary glands along the palate to help moisten and keep that denture in place. So yes, a realigning of denture can help. It may not help, but it can help. And hydrating the mouth beforehand, putting water in the denture as you put it into place to get some suction will help as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you all.